AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, November 9, 2011, here on WILL AM 580 with Media Matters. We've got a great show for you today. Someone we've been had on the show once before, who we've been waiting to get back when his new book came out, Wendell Potter, will be joining us today to discuss Deadly Spin, how an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. An exceptional new book, which we'll be talking about for the next hour, Public Relations and Healthcare. Hope you'll join us. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
The FCC is expected to complete its review of the proposed merger between the country's biggest cable provider, Comcast, and the powerhouse broadcaster, NBC. The merger would give Comcast enormous power to control what you can see and how you can see it, both online and on your TV. To sweeten the deal for regulators, Comcast has made several promises to keep its monopolistic tendencies at bay. Last week, Comcast announced another promise. It would strike up partnerships between local NBC news stations and new nonprofit journalism enterprises in communities across the country. Sounds good on the surface, but is it really going to bolster local news? Josh Stearns of Free Press is not convinced.
These partnerships would only take place in five places, according to Comcast, and those NBC stations would actually have no obligation to broadcast the news and journalism that was produced. So these are truly symbolic partnerships.
Stearns is wary of any promises made by Comcast or NBC. He says that if history is any guide when it comes to media mergers, promises were made to be broken.
Back in 2002, when NBC was buying up Telemundo, they promised to radically increase the amount of news and information for Spanish-speaking populations that Telemundo would do. And then, just a couple months later, they laid off 700 people at local Telemundo stations. They closed the newsrooms at some of the top Spanish-speaking media markets around the country, and they began farming out that journalism from one station in Texas.
As for Comcast, it has a long history of shutting the door on local news on public access stations.
Take Philadelphia, for example, where Comcast for years blocked Philadelphia from having a community access television station on their cable network.
After years of community activism, Philadelphia has its station. But if Comcast had its way, Stern says, there would be no public access on its network. And in terms of broadband access, Comcast is no friend of net neutrality, the First Amendment of the Internet.
It's ironic, really, that one of the biggest advocates against network neutrality, which is one of the most important free speech issues of our time, is now coming out saying that they support local news and information. But if we don't have net neutrality, which Comcast has tried to block at every turn, these local journalism sites that Comcast claims to support would actually have an even harder time getting their information out to local citizens.
For more information, go to savethenews.org.
While the Pulitzer Prize heralds the best of journalism, there's another contest that highlights the worst, or should I say stinkiest, moments in American journalism. Called the PU Litzers, this list documents 2010's most rotten reporting in mainstream media. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a media watchdog organization, compiles the list, which includes over a dozen egregious stories that spread misinformation, inflammatory rhetoric, and irresponsible journalism. Peter Hart of Fair explains how they chose the winners.
Our general rule is that things that made you smack your forehead when you read them or saw them are probably going to make it into the PU Litzers at the end of the year.
One winner was CNN anchor Kiran Chetri, who referred to the middle class as those earning $250,000 during a segment on American Morning. In fact, 98% of U.S. households make less than $250,000. Another PU Litzer appointee was the Washington Post David Broder, who suggested in a column that President Obama begin a war with Iran to jumpstart our economy and improve bipartisanship. Hart said our corporatized media system is set up to breed these types of stories, which are increasingly showing up in what are considered centrist media outlets.
you always have to remember that this is a media system that is owned by corporations and largely dominated by corporate advertising. So journalism that would seek to offend those interests would be antithetical to the business model. Advertisers wouldn't want to underwrite it, and corporations wouldn't want to own that kind of media system. You know, the idea that you could blithely suggest the United States bomb another country in order to promote bipartisanship, it's an extremist idea, but it comes from the center of American journalism. I think that says something very powerful about where corporate media's ideology lies.
Hart hopes the Pulitzers help to educate the public about why our media system is so harmful.
The main point is the point that we've always tried to make, that if you're going to care about media concentration and consolidation, you have to figure out what it is about that media system that offends you. And this gives us one opportunity among many to make that argument, that the reason we oppose big media is because they do a bad job.
To read the full list of winners, visit www.fair.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, January 9th, 2010, here in WILL AM 580. Back after a two-week hiatus with recorded programs, and I'm glad to be back here. And what a good way to start the year with an extraordinary new book that I've had the privilege of reading over the last week, Deadly Spin. We have its author with us today, Wendell Potter, who's been on the show before, and I think is well-known to many of the listeners to Media Matters. Wendell Potter is the senior fellow on healthcare currently at the Center for Media and Democracy, but for 25 years worked in public relations, working up the ladder until finally he was the head of public relations for the Cigna Insurance Company for the last 10 or so years of his career. Wendell Potter, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob. Awfully good to be back.
Well, I must say, I read a lot of books for a living and sometimes for pleasure. This one qualifies on both counts. It was really a delightful read and an excellent introduction to the subject of both public relations and to healthcare public relations specifically.
Well, thank you. I was hoping to achieve that, and I have to say I give some credit to the editor, my editor at Bloomsbury, for helping to guide that and wanting to make sure that I also injected some of my personal transformation story in there to try to hold the reader interest if it might flag during some of the more technical parts.
Well, you did that, and you did it well, and I think that's probably a good way to start. I'm so familiar with your story, and I know some of our listeners are, that I probably make the assumption that, you know, you are now a household name, but I don't think that's fair to say. Why don't we start by just talking a little bit about your personal story that's in the book and that some of our listeners might be familiar with, you know, how you got from Tennessee in 1975 or so to this radio show today in 2 minutes or less.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I grew up in a very rural part and remote part of Tennessee. It was when I was born, northeastern part of Tennessee, which is in the southern Appalachians. And it's just right across the state line from Virginia, where a lot of the coal mining sections of that state are. And my parents were not people of significant means at all. We had a small family farm. My mom and dad had a little grocery store in the country. But to cut, I guess, a few years off, I graduated from the University of Tennessee. I was the first person in my family to graduate from college. And I began my first career in journalism. I was a reporter in Memphis and then later in Nashville. And I ultimately was given a promotion to report and cover cover Congress in the White House for Scripps Howard News Service. I you know, was very fortunate to be able to do that and advance pretty quickly. I was still in my 20s when I was covering Congress in the White House. I decided, though, to I remember thinking that I think this is somewhat of a rationalization. I was somewhat homesick for Tennessee, and I said I really would like to be a participant in events rather than just a reporter of them. So I accepted an offer to go back to Tennessee and join a campaign for governor. The Democratic nominee for governor, who became the nominee, invited me to be his press secretary. And that began my PR career. I had been in PR for quite a long time. And after a few other things that I did prior to going to work for Humana, I began working as a corporate PR person in for-profit insurance, beginning with Humana in 1989. And I, over the course of really two decades, was a leading PR person in the insurance industry for Humana and for really almost 15 years for Cigna.
And then, you know, you chronicle in the book what you did at Cigna, what public relations entailed. And for a lot of people, and certainly including me, this was, you know, you sort of hear terms like public relations, you hear names like Cigna, but they're sort of, they don't really mean a lot. And then I read this book and I see what exactly you were doing, what that entails. And also, it really gave me a sense of just how enormous Cigna was. I mean, when you talked about the CEO salaries at Cigna, I mean, it was like the equivalent of the GDP of a small third world country.
Oh, it's absolutely correct. And there was a reason I wrote the book, was to explain things and to pull the curtains back so that people really understand how big and powerful these companies are and how much money they make. And the fact that these are all for-profit corporations that I write about, largely, and that our health insurance system is controlled by a cartel of very, very large for-profit companies, two of which I work for, and that they now control our healthcare system in ways that I felt it was important for Americans to know.
And when you were doing public relations, you know, that is a term that we use all the time, but it has a formal definition that you give in the book that the public relations associations that use and the textbooks use. But that seemed to be askew from the reality of what you did in public relations and what public relations is in the real world of politics.
Oh, it's very true. I studied public relations in college. My degree is in communications. My emphasis was print journalism. But I took all the PR courses that the university offered. I was intrigued by the profession, and I thought even then that I might want to get into PR. And you're right, the textbook PR, the PR that you're taught in college, bears little resemblance to what I found I was doing in the latter years, certainly of my career. I've heard a lot of people who said over the years that I'd like to go into PR because I'm good with people. And there's kind of this, I think, perception that a lot of PR people are just kind of glad-handers and a good face for an organization.
Sort of like greeters at the casino or something, like Joe Louis used to do.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But what they don't teach you and what people don't really know is the dark arts PR and the sinister side, which I ultimately came to realize in the toward the end of my career that what I was doing in PR was frankly the exact opposite of what I had been trained to do and was doing as a journalist. When I was a reporter, I took my job very seriously. I tried to be as nonpartisan and unbiased as possible. I felt it was very, very important to be objective. But beyond that, to tell the truth and to make sure that I wasn't selectively disclosing information that would skew something. I found that that's precisely what I was doing in my job in PR too many times. I was purposely selectively disclosing information or statistics or anecdotes to make people think something when in fact it wasn't necessarily true.
In fact, in the book, one of the nice things you do, Wendell Potter, is talk about the really common practices of modern contemporary public relations, which is primarily used by large firms to sort of push their agenda politically or commercially to get their way and to sort of diffuse public opinion, change public opinion, diffuse opposition to their positions. And it was fascinating to read some of these techniques. What are a couple of the basics that people should look out for if they want to sort of get a handle on how public relations is used in our society today?
Well, one is called reframing the debate, and we're seeing that. We saw it during the campaign, this most recent campaign. We saw it during the healthcare reform debate. Here's an example, and this actually hits two or three things at one time. It's very important to pay attention to language and to make sure that your language is understandable and that your comments are very brief and that they're brief enough that someone can say them over and over and over again to the point that people start believing them. The legislation was called the government takeover of the healthcare system just constantly by advocates of the status quo and opponents of reform. And That was purposely chosen because of the words and the fact that it resonated emotionally with people. It created an image that was intended to scare people, and I'll get to that too, because at the heart of these campaigns is often fear-mongering and then anger-mongering. And I named the book Deadly Spin for not just because I thought it was a nifty title, but because it's true. And we're unfortunately seeing the consequences of Deadly Spin in Arizona. But we also see it every day, and that, as I mentioned in the book, 45,000 people die every year because they don't have insurance. And people like me have been at work trying to persuade America that there's no big deal, no real problem with the fact that people don't have insurance. It can be an inconvenience, but it's not necessarily a problem, and a lot of people decide to go without insurance by choice. Another thing that big PR firms do for their clients is set up front groups, and one was set up that I was a part of just to discredit Michael Moore as a movie maker, and to discredit his film Sicko in particular. The front group was called Healthcare America, and it was purported to be a grassroots organization, but it was nothing of the kind. It was paid for by our premium dollars, and those of us who have private insurance, a big chunk of what we pay every month in our premiums is skimmed off to go into activities that are intended to mislead or to set up front groups like this or to engage in a fear-mongering or anger-mongering campaign. So reframing the debate, you want to make people think that this legislation is a government takeover when, of course, it's not. You want to come up with a term that people can remember, and your allies can say it so often that people start to believe it, and they internalize it, and they will begin to vote against their own best interest, as we've seen happen time and time again.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Wendell Potter. We're talking with him live, but we're talking about his new book, Deadly Spin, which is about his history as a health insurance executive and sort of coming out of the closet, so to speak, as an opponent to public relations and to the health insurance industry in the last 2 years, probably the most significant opponent to the industry in the country over the last 2 years. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments to Media Matters, the telephone number here is 333-9455. The toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Our lines are open. We welcome your calls. You know, one of the things that I was familiar with, and I teach this and I write about it, but still reading it in your book was chilling to me, Wendell Potter, which was what seemed like the success that came without tremendous difficulty for you when you worked at Cigna and maybe for other public relations people, for other firms, getting the news media, such as it is, to pretty much print what you wanted them to print and really play a decisive role in advancing the corporate cause.
Oh, absolutely. It's I was always amazed at what I was able to get away with the media. And part of the reason is because of what has happened to largely our mainstream media over the last several years. We've seen newsrooms shrink. We've seen reporters lose their jobs, and of course, papers closing. There are far fewer reporters now doing journalism, professional journalism, than there were a few years ago. And a lot of those folks who've lost their jobs have gone into PR. So there are far more PR people now than there are journalists in this country, which is a kind of a scary thing when you start to think about it. And because there are so few of them, they have to work especially hard. They don't have the time to do the kind of investigative pieces that they once did. And sometimes their publishers and editors don't want them to in the first place, but first of all, there's little time to do it. They have very little time to work on even individual stories or even simple stories. And because of that, they often would willingly accept just a statement that I would email to them and say, this is it. This is all we're going to say about it. So when you do that, you essentially are shutting down a conversation with a reporter. And 9 times out of 10, if not even more, the reporter will wind up printing your statement, which has been blessed by the attorneys that needed to see it and the CEO if he needed to be involved. And it was just a piece of corporate PR and winds up as being a part of a legitimate news story. The other thing we do is develop close relationships with reporters to try to make sure that when they're writing a story that involves us, that they're kindly toward us. And that was a big part of my job, was developing close relationships with reporters.
And as I understood it from reading your book, Wendell Potter, one of the key mechanisms you had as head of public relations for Cigna, or anyone in your position would for another corporation, is that you were the one who would allow for access to your CEO. So any reporter who wanted to talk to the CEO had to go through you, which meant if you were not looking upon them favorably, they weren't going to get access to that source.
That's right. I was the gatekeeper, or as George Bush would say, I was the decider. I would decide who was worthy to talk to the CEO. And whenever a request came in from someone, some reporter to talk to the CEO, I'd make an assessment as to whether or not his or her news organization was significant enough to bother with. And then I would, if I thought maybe so, I would begin doing a very quick check to find out what this reporter had written in the past or broadcast in the past. And then I would determine what questions the reporter might ask. I would insist on that. I'd say, what do you want to ask the CEO? So I would know a lot going into this, and I would even do background checks. There are ways to get a lot of personal information about reporters, and I would always do that. When I would decide that it was okay for a reporter to talk to the CEO, I would develop what I called a significant staffing memo with a compilation of some of the stories that the reporter had written and a brief bio and a cover memo with here are the questions that you can expect to be asked and here are some answers you might want to consider. And then, when the interview took place, I would always either be on the phone or in the room if it was an in-person interview. So I controlled it. I controlled access completely.
Yeah, and in one point in your book, you're talking about, I think it's one of the final episodes where you're working on the Nadine Sarkissian story, which I want to get to in a second, where you're concerned that the Wall Street Journal or Forbes reporter might be going in the direction that wouldn't be favorable to Cigna, and you're just about to intervene to cut it off when it goes into a favorable way. And I thought it was striking the way you put it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I was sweating that one, and I knew that I was going to have to say, well, sorry, but we're going to have to wind this up because the doctor's got to go off to another appointment right away. So thanks for your time, and we'll talk to you later.
Well, that does lead to, and I don't know if I have the correct pronunciation of the last name. I think Nadine Sarkissian, is that
Sarkissian,
correct?
Sarkissian, yeah.
Sarkissian, and this story is important in your book. You spend a lot of time talking about it. I think, if I understood it, both as part of your personal transformation, because it's really the last major episode in your career in corporate public relations, and it's Cigna right before you sort of leave and go to the other side. And also, it's such an important example of the crisis of healthcare in this country and the dimensions of it. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about Nadine Sarkissian's story, Nadine, and how it affected you and what it meant.
I think it affected me so much because I have a daughter who's just a few years older than Nadine. Nadine, when she was 14, was diagnosed with leukemia, and treatment was successful. It went into remission for a while, but it came back when she was 16, and she ultimately had to have a bone marrow transplant, and then her doctor said she had to have a liver transplant. And they said, her doctors at UCLA, she lived in Los Angeles, that she'd have a 65% chance of living if she did get that transplant. And the family was worried, of course, but they felt that, that would be not a problem, at least in terms of getting coverage for it, because they knew that their health benefit plan covered transplants. They showed up for the transplant the morning that it was scheduled. A perfect match had been found for Nadine, and the doctors took them aside when they arrived and said, "I'm sorry, but we haven't gotten clearance from Cigna to do this." And they were just astonished. They didn't know what that meant. What it meant was that a corporate doctor 2,500 miles away in Pittsburgh who worked for Cigna had made the decision after reviewing the paperwork that in his view it was not an appropriate procedure, that it would be experimental in her case. And he stuck by that decision until the family, they were able to get a lot of attention focused on this case. They got the California Nurses Association involved. They got the Armenian community involved. There's a large Armenian community in Los Angeles, and they were able to get a lot of media attention locally, and it got to be national, to the point that Cigna was realizing that it was taking a big public relations black eye, needed to do something to keep the matters from getting worse, fearing, of course, that if Nadalene died and they hadn't covered the procedure, that it would be far, far worse. So the company, because of this public pressure, or as a consequence of it, decided to cover it. Unfortunately, the news was communicated to the family and the doctors when it was too late. By this time, so many days had passed since the original request that her other organs were beginning to shut down, and she just was not able to have the transplant and died just a few hours after Cigna agreed to cover it. I was a person who was on the line with the reporters during this whole thing, which went on for days, and it just took its toll on me. I, in my career, had handled what we called high-profile cases on a regular basis. We also call them horror stories, and this was one that I guess I got more personally involved in, maybe because it had such high media attention and emotional impact, and it involved a 17-year-old girl. For whatever reason, it just was the final one. I decided I just didn't have it in me to keep doing this anymore, to keep defending an industry that I had come to realize was the direct cause for so many of the seemingly intractable problems in our healthcare system.
Well, also, it seems that the Sarkisian case was important because occurring late in 2007, as the presidential race is heating up in both parties, but especially in the Democratic side, where healthcare was arguably the most important issue being debated, that this seemed to be a log on the fire for those who wanted dramatic healthcare reform. So it alarmed the industry in ways that are even greater than would have been the case otherwise.
Oh, absolutely. The industry got very, very involved in this at the trade association level. I was on many conference calls with leaders at America's Health Insurance Plans as we were discussing the situation and planning PR strategy for how to handle this. We had the worry that at least one Democratic candidate probably would pick up the story and use it to illustrate some of the problems in the system. And sure enough, that happened. John Edwards took note of this and started talking about it and even invited the family to appear at a campaign stop for him in New Hampshire. So it really did scare the industry a great deal. So after Nadalene died, the spin did not end. In fact, it just kind of kicked into higher gear because the industry was afraid that because Nadalene had died, more and more people would just become completely outraged at the heartless insurance industry and demand change, and that it would facilitate the election of a Democratic candidate who would be hard on the industry.
Our guest today in Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Wendell Potter, the author of the brand new book, Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. I've had the privilege of reading this book over the last week, and I found it extremely readable and very much aimed at a layperson. You don't need to be an expert in healthcare or public relations to enjoy this book and learn a great deal from it. I certainly did, and I'll be stealing from it, Wendell, liberally. In the future, in my classes and in my writing, for that matter.
Happy to know that. Thank you.
And, you know, one of the things you go through in the book, and I think why you became a public figure, is that you left Cigna and went to the other side, or the dark side or light side, depending upon one's perspective, right in the teeth of the debate over Obamacare, of the Democrats' plan for some sort of reform of health care. And you came out as sort of one exposing the other side's propaganda while it was taking place. And talk a little bit about, you know, what, you know, how you regarded the Obamacare package and the debates as they took place. And, you know, what you saw in terms of the spin coming out of your old colleagues from the industry.
You know, it was the spin that was coming out that made me finally decide I couldn't just sit on the sidelines. When I left my job, I didn't go directly to becoming an advocate for reform. I didn't even know that I would have the nerve to do that. I thought that I might be able to maybe advise advocates behind the scenes and do it anonymously because I was fearful of doing it publicly. But when I began to see the spin, I just realized that I couldn't sit on the sidelines. First of all, but just to back up, I thought that when Barack Obama became the nominee, he would really shepherd a very comprehensive health care reform plan package through Congress, because he had campaigned on one on that, as the other Democratic candidates had too. But he was opposed during his campaign to a requirement that we all have to buy insurance from private insurance companies, because he said he didn't think we should be forced to buy something that we can't afford. And he also said that he felt it was vitally important that we had the option of a public option. And I was encouraged by that, too. But I saw soon after he was elected that the insurance industry was really working hard to persuade him to change his mind and to set the tone of the debate in ways that would be very favorable to the industry. And I saw that happen. I saw the head of America's Health Insurance Plans, the big trade association, stand up at the end of the president's first summit on health care reform and tell him that, Mr. President, you can count on the industry to work with you and members of Congress to pass good legislation. And I knew that was not genuine, because I had been a part of efforts to try to derail reform or to shape it in ways that the industry wanted. So I wasn't surprised when the bill that was passed included the individual mandate, because the industry lobbied hard for it. The industry is incredibly influential in Washington, and they knew what they needed to do to get the president to come on board, and they did it. And they worked, you know, that was job one. Job two was to make sure there was no public option in the legislation. So I was very disappointed that they prevailed there as well. It almost was included in final legislation, but the Senate, you know, they got enough people in the Senate, like Joe Lieberman, to come out against it, that, you know, it just was a death knell. So, you know, Joe Lieberman represents the insurance industry in Connecticut, or did. And so that wasn't necessarily a big surprise, but it was a huge disappointment. The legislation that was passed, I will say, though, does many good things. The industry doesn't like a lot of the good things that it does, which is why they were so involved in the campaigns in the midterms to elect more Republicans to Congress. They want to try to strip out what is good in the legislation and leave behind the individual mandate, which will require us to buy their overpriced and undervalued products.
Wendell Potter, one of the other big stories during the debate over health care during 2009 and into 2010 was the Tea Party's emergence as sort of a primary organizer, a grassroots organizer against the Obama proposed health care plan or any health care insurance reform whatsoever. And things like death panels and government takeover. All this was heard, and on the news repeatedly, this was given a sort of this upsurge of really average Americans and working class and middle class Americans who were just completely outraged by this sort of government assault on human liberty. From your perspective, working in public relations and knowing how the industry is working, what did you make of that?
Well, I knew that the industry was involved in stoking the anger and actually funding the some of the Tea Party efforts. I was invited to speak at one of the town hall meetings in September 2009, just in the midst of the health care reform debate, and it was during that summer when the Tea Party folks were most vocal and were showing up to disrupt so many of these town hall meetings. And so I saw it up close and personal, just exactly what they were doing. They didn't come with any intention of trying to learn anything or to really have a respectful conversation with the congressman. They were there to disrupt, to shout out what the congressman had to say, or shut him down or her down. And I knew that this was part of the fear-mongering and anger-mongering effort to get people so opposed to health care reform that they would show up. One woman at that particular event, I was trying to be heard over the noise of the crowd and explain what more or less what I'm saying on this program. And she was having none of it. I'm not sure she could even hear me, but she came up to me afterward, after it was over, and really almost wagging her finger in my face, said, "No one paid me to be here. I came on my own." And I said, "Ma'am, I know no one paid you a dime to get here, but a lot of money was paid to get you here. You didn't get any of it, but a lot of it went on behind the scenes. A lot of premium dollars were paid to get you as worked up as you are to get here." And that's much of what's going on. I use that just to illustrate the fact that we're so easily manipulated. And the industry, and not just the health insurance industry, but almost any industry that has a political goal in mind, knows that it's important to manipulate public opinion to influence public policy, and that's what goes on.
Our guest today, Media Matters, Wendell Potter. The number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Lines are open if you want to call. Wendell Potter, the author of the brand-new book, Deadly Spin, just out by Bloomsbury Press, on his career as a PR executive in the health insurance industry and as an activist for healthcare reform and in exposing corporate public relations, which this book does. Wendell Potter, back in the early 90s, there was, and you write about this in the book, the effort by the Clinton administration in their first 2 years to enact serious healthcare reform, which failed. And one of the things that was striking about that, and I don't think you refer to it in the book, but there was a study done at the University of Pennsylvania of news coverage of the healthcare debate during 1993 and into early 1994. And they had two control groups, one of which got sort of complete huge pile of all the news coverage of the healthcare debate. And then another group that got a very select pile, much smaller, randomly selected from the large pile, over a 6 or 9 month period. And what they discovered is the people who read tons of the material were exposed to more newscast coverage of the healthcare debate, understood less about it than those who just got a brief sampling of it, that the quantity just confused them, and that most people had trouble understanding anything that was really going on and what the issues were, how the industry worked, what was at stake, what the costs were. And it was a damning study of our news media and how it basically did a very poor job of drawing citizens into the process. What would be your guess such a study might determine in 2009, 2010 for how our news media covered the healthcare debates we've just gone through?
You get exactly the same results, which is another thing that was so frustrating to me. I was a part of the effort to try to kill the Clinton plan, I hate to say. And I saw that. The same dynamic and the same ineffectiveness of the media and not just ineffectiveness, but the same thing, I think you would have the same results because one of the things that was so frustrating for me as I was watching it from this different perspective was how inadequate if not inadequate, just probably not even intending to provide the real reasons why we were having this this debate in the first place on the part of many reporters, including some of the most prominent ones. I will even go after the New York Times. I think that the coverage, by and large, there of what was going on in Washington was just no better than any coverage in that it was just more or less a reporting of what was going on that particular day in Congress. I think anyone who was paying attention to the media would have quickly lost the idea of why are we doing this? What's really going on in our country that makes it necessary for us to have a debate every few years to reform our healthcare system? And that is part of the that's part of what the industry wants to happen. They want it to be a coverage of just a contest, almost like you would cover a sporting event or a political campaign. Who's winning today, the Democrats or the Republicans? Whose messaging is getting across? What's happening in this particular committee? And at the local level, there was far less coverage, in my view, of this debate than there was in 1993 and 94, because there's far little space for national news or international news in the local media.
Our guest, Wendell Potter. Let's go to the phone lines now for a caller. Line 1, Muhammad, you're on Media Matters.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to know how many years you worked for Sigma, what kind of income did you make during those years, and how long did it take you to realize what was going on? I'm an RN, and I've seen this through the years. The hospitals, the doctors, the pharmaceuticals, the insurance. It's not just the insurance companies. It's everybody. Everybody's in on the take, and they all want to keep theirs. If you look at the European countries that all have national health care, they set the price on everything, on drugs, on hospitals, on doctors, everything they set the price. Obama never did that. Never even try to do that. If you did that, you could have a national health care program, and it would work. They also have a no fancy, extra, superficial, you know, extraordinary procedures that are included in their plans. I would like for you to respond.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Wendell Potter?
I worked for Cigna for a total of 15 years, and I wasn't head of communications all that time. That was just toward the end of my career. Most people who work at insurance companies don't see what I ultimately saw, and I was, I guess, unique in that toward the end of my career, I was the PR person for the company, but I was also involved in a lot of activities at the trade association level. So I saw how insurance companies work at both the corporate executive level and at the trade association level. But I want to emphasize, this was toward the end of my career. You don't see that perspective if you're an employee of an insurance company in the lower ranks. You can go to work day after day and not realize, you can't really see the forest for the trees. You don't understand exactly all that the companies do, as I describe in my book, to make sure that they're meeting Wall Street's expectations. Only a few people are able to get a glimpse into exactly what these companies do to do that. And I'll emphasize that this is the objective is to meet Wall Street's and shareholders' objectives, because these are for-profit companies. Your question about Obama, and you're right, and a lot of the other countries around the world that have where people spend far less on their health care than we do. We have the most expensive health care system on the planet. We pay more on a per capita basis than anywhere else. But we also have one of the most inequitable healthcare systems, ranking behind Bangladesh, believe it or not, according to the World Health Organization. And our outcomes are not good compared to other industrialized countries or developed countries. And in terms of fairness, we're among the worst. The reality is, and I trust you'll read the book, because I try to explain why it is so hard for meaningful reform to get passed. It wasn't Obama's call to change it. His hands were limited. There were many times I kept waiting for the White House to roll out a more effective communications campaign, but it never happened for whatever reason. I don't know why. There was no debate, as you may recall, on a single-payer system in this country. And the reason for that is because members of Congress had been persuaded by special interest that that was a non-starter. If you start with that, we're going to go nuclear, and we will really poison the environment to the point that you're not going to get anything passed. These guys control our political system, and until we come to terms with that, until we're, as a nation, realizing what has really happened to our democracy, this is going to continue.
You know, let's talk about one person who comes up in the book who's had a position similar to yours, and she almost plays a starring role, and I think you might have referred to her earlier in the show, and I don't know if I have the pronunciation of her last name right, Karen Ignani?
Ignani.
Ignani. And she has a very interesting history, and she comes from a background not unlike your own, but from a different part of the country. Talk a little bit about her and what she does today.
Yeah, Karen Ignani grew up in the Northeast, in a working-class environment. She actually started working in Washington for some Democrats and wound up working in the labor area for the AFL-CIO. She was involved at one point in helping to develop policies regarding health care for the labor movement and to the AFL-CIO. But she was recruited to a job heading up a trade association for HMOs back at the same time that I joined the industry, or as I was coming to work for Cigna. And she truly rose up through the ranks to the point that she now heads America's Health Insurance Plans, the biggest trade association. There are two. There's one that's called the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, which comprises just the Blue Cross plans around the country. But America's Health Insurance Plans, which goes by the acronym of AHIP, comprises the Blue Cross plans and all the others as well. And they are the AHIP is dominated by the big for-profits that I have talked about. There are seven of them that are are so big that now one out of every three of us is enrolled in some kind of a medical plan operated by one of these big seven for-profit companies. And I work for two of them, Cigna and Humana. But she is extraordinarily skillful and is, without a doubt, one of the most effective lobbyists on Capitol Hill. She's been there long enough to understand how things get done in Washington, and particularly in Congress. She's extraordinarily good with the news media. She stays on message. She's very good at crafting messages. She's got an extraordinarily good staff, which our premium dollars pays for. So she is. She was once asked, Uwe Reinhardt, who is a healthcare economist who's often quoted and highly regarded, was once asked how much she is, how much she's paid. And he said, "Whatever she's paid is not enough." And he meant by that for the health insurance industry, for what she's been able to deliver. She was very instrumental, at the time that he said that, in making sure that the Medicare Part D drug program for the Medicare program was passed in such a way that it would benefit the insurance industry. It certainly benefits the pharmaceutical industry, but it also benefits the insurance industry. And she helped pull off quite a coup for the insurance industry back then as well.
And these are coups that really end up in billions or tens of billions of dollars of revenue and almost as much in profits eventually down the road when you win these coups.
Yeah.
So her salary, which I think in the book you mentioned was $1.8 million at one point, is really chump change if you're delivering that sort of return on it. They're glad to give her whatever it takes.
They are. And the same is true with PR. As well. PR is pretty cost effective. It's not enormously expensive to carry on these fear and anger mongering campaigns, but the return on investment is very, very high.
You know, at the end of the book, or in your penultimate chapter, I think, Wendell Potter, you sort of go out and look at some of the other major industries in our country and how they incorporate public relations and some of the cutting edge issues of the last few years. I thought that was really interesting. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of those in the remaining 10 minutes of the show if we can. Because one of the points you make, specifically about tobacco, but I think you could make it about all the industries, including healthcare, is that these industries all have sort of something we regard that they do, like make cigarettes or provide health insurance. But half of their industry, or a big chunk of it, is doing public relations and lobbying and sort of getting favorable government subsidies and contracts and regulations. That's almost as big a part of what they do as the actual economic function they have.
Oh, it's absolutely true. A big part of what these companies do goes beyond the manufacture of the products or other than the manufacture of products and the selling of the services. Also in healthcare, by the way, just as an aside, about 30% of what we spend in this country goes to administrative functions. That's another reason why we pay so much, and we pay so much in administration because we've got this crazy system involving so many, these multiple insurance carriers, and they require doctors and hospitals to have incredibly big administrative staff just to handle the paperwork that they make necessary. So we spend a lot of money that other countries don't spend just because of that. And we call it the free market system, but the free market system has set up this thing that a lot of the people who work for insurance companies work in sections that are for marketing and sales and underwriting and PR and it goes on and on and on. But a big part of the revenue is spent on manipulating public opinion and as a part of an overall effort to shape public policy so that there are no laws passed that are onerous, no regulations that are too hard to live with.
Well, let's start with the tobacco industry, which I think is probably the classic textbook case of public relations in action in America today.
Yeah, and in fact, I've got a section called The Playbook because it was largely put together for the tobacco industry by big PR firms. People hold the industry in pretty low esteem because they know it sells cancerous products, deadly products. But they've been able to they engaged in a big campaign for many years to try to persuade us that the Surgeon General that science was not solid. There was no real health danger. dangers to smoking cigarettes. And then later, the same campaign to try to make sure that we weren't too scared of secondhand smoke. And they tried to, you know, they forestalled for many years the laws that prohibit restaurants from having smokers in there. So they've been able to engage in these activities, setting up front groups, and a lot of the same tactics are followed, as I point out in the book, by insurance companies, by food and beverage industries, by the oil and gas industry, and by the banking industry, just to name a few.
You know, let me stop you there if I can, Wendell, because we have a couple callers on the line I do want to get to before the show ends, and one of them is all the way from Vienna, Austria. So let's go to line two now, Vienna, Austria. Hello, you're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Hi, thanks so much for letting me talk to you. I find this debate fascinating. I grew up in the United States, but I've lived here in Vienna, Austria for the past 35 years. Once while I was on vacation in the United States, needed to go to the hospital, and it was at the Carl Clinic, and it was because one of my daughters fell and hurt her chin, and we spent more time going through all of the insurance rigmaroles and everything else before we could even get the treatment. I sort of am fascinated by the debate that's going on in the United States about health care. Yes, we pay higher taxes here, our income is higher, but I've been in hospitals in the United States, and I've been in hospitals over here. And I guess what really annoys me, especially when I hear people always pointing at the European examples and of how bad insurance is and things like this, you know, I don't go to sleep at night worrying about whether I'm going to be able to afford the deductible, whether I'm going to be able to afford the next medical bills. I pay higher taxes. I've done that my whole life. But, you know, I'd like to just say to people in America, you know, you are in Champaign-Urbana, I think you're being duped if you think that everything about a national health care plan is bad, because I am a recipient or a beneficiary of it over here. Now, granted, our taxes are higher, but we pay for it. But I think it's a very good thing and would love to see something. I'd love to see my own parents getting the same level of care and treatment over there that I get over here. It was just a comment just to sort of counteract all of the negative, you know, propaganda that one hears about how apparently bad our systems are over here, because I don't know. I think they're very good.
Well, I'd like to talk with you further, maybe offline, because the thing is, most Americans don't understand what you're saying is true. Few of us travel abroad. We don't understand foreign systems. We are afraid of them. We're made to be afraid of them. The campaign against SICKA, the biggest part of that was to scare us away from European-style health care, believe it or not. You probably can believe it. But they're so effective that they have made us fear. And we don't know different, if you know what I mean. But most of us don't have a clue how good it could be elsewhere, or just how bad we really have it, because they just don't have any experience of any other kind of system.
Now, let me.
My wife was a registered nurse in the States, and she's a registered nurse over here. And you know, I'll just mention one thing. When I was growing up, my family had a very difficult time getting insurance for me because of a pre-existing condition, and my pre-existing condition was blindness. So I don't have very many good things to say about an American system that tells people that they certainly don't want what we have here in Europe, because I think anybody who says that and perhaps, like you said, hasn't been here is really being duped. I feel very strongly about that.
Well, thank you very much, caller. I greatly appreciate your calling us and giving your insights on that.
Thank you very much.
Let's now go to our next caller who's been waiting patiently. Urbana, line one, you're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Yeah, first I just wanted to kind of piggyback on what that guy said. You know, the media really is complicit in not getting out the message that the system in Europe works and the system here doesn't work. And you guys have kind of talked about that. But the reason why I was calling is I was just wondering, the Republicans are now saying that they're going to go after health care reform to do what they can to repeal it. And I certainly am a huge supporter of single-payer health care system. Personally, I think that's the only thing that's really going to reform it. I'm kind of, you know, in the middle. You know, should I think that, you know, should it be repealed and just start all over? Or, you know, should we try to just work with it and see if we can make it better? And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Thanks.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Thank you, caller.
Yeah, and it's almost a moot point because they're not going to repeal it. That's just political rhetoric, and it won't because the insurance industry likes what we've got enough that their friends in the Republican Party are not going to repeal it. What will happen? They'll have a vote to repeal it in the House. It will pass. It will not pass in the Senate because the Senate is still controlled by the Democrats. They won't even bring it up as a bill on the Senate floor probably. So it will never reach the president. What the Republicans will do is they'll tell their base, the people that have elected them, that think it is the right thing to do, that they've given it their best shot. So it's the big bad Senate that's keeping us from doing the will of the people. So that's how they will spin it. But they have no intention of repealing this because their friends in the insurance industry have had a talk with them already and said, look, we like this bill. What we don't like are some of the consumer protections that are in it. So if you can strip those out and keep the individual mandate, then we'll be sure to help get you reelected next time. Call me cynical, but I used to cover Congress, and I know how these things work, and I know how the insurance industry works with in its public policy.
Let's go back to the phone lines now again to line 4. Peoria has been waiting patiently. Peoria, you're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Yeah, you were talking about the tobacco industry, and it made me think about Illinois, where the casinos say that they can't compete unless they can have people smoking in the casinos, both of which are revenue sources for the state, which is probably pretty broke, but it's kind of amusing, sort of.
You know, they play that tactic a lot in all industries. That is closely associated with the fear-mongering of if you change something that we don't like, then people are going to lose their jobs. And it's not for just coincidence that the Republicans are calling their bill in the House, just a two-page bill, the bill to repeal the job-killing health care reform bill. They use that term specifically. It's one of the tactics in the playbook that I write about.
Fire-tested rhetoric that works.
Exactly right.
We have time for one more caller, Muhammad. I believe on line 1, you're on the air with Wendell Potter. Muhammad, are you? I guess maybe we lost Muhammad. Well, Wendell, we've only got about a minute left, and just one question I had for you is, you know, how have your old colleagues who you worked with at Cigna in the healthcare, public relations, and lobbying industry, how have those who've stayed in the fray on the other side responded to your transition and your new book?
By and large, most of them have just tried to ignore me and tried to avoid saying anything about me, and when they are asked by the media about me, they'll provide a benign statement. They don't want to say anything that's too provocative to create a story about me or give me credibility that I might not have if they didn't say something. But I have heard separately and quietly from some of my former colleagues there who've called and wished me well, and I've had calls and emails from many, many people who are in PR for the industry, who were my peers, who've left the industry but have not, you know, had the nerve to speak out, who've encouraged me to keep going on.
It should be wonderful if they did. Wendell Potter, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Thank you so much for taking time from your schedule to come here and talk about your new book, Deadly Spin.
My pleasure, Bob. Thank you very much for having me on.
My great pleasure. And I want to thank Kyle Kroha for being my engineer. Melissa Trentz, as always, for being my phenomenal producer. Next week, we'll have Bob Poland, the economist, on to talk about the state of our economy and the media coverage of it and the options we face. Should be a great show. Until then, for the next 167 hours, this is Bob McChesney saying, everyone, have a great week and Happy New Year.
You're one of 170 million Americans who stay informed or get inspired.
One of 170 million Americans who use public media every month. That's more than half the country. Now public media needs your support.
Make sure the programming you need in your community stays in your community. Learn more about federal funding for public media at 170millionamericans.org.
A couple of more quiet days, and then another winter storm moves into the Midwest, and we could see 3 to 4 inches of snow beginning after midnight tomorrow night and continuing throughout the day on Tuesday. Today, though, mostly sunny, a high near 23. Tonight, mostly cloudy, overnight low 17, and then cloudy tomorrow with a high near 29. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL.